The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this machine and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wilson. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wilson.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in tonight. We have another interesting first-time guest on the Space Show tonight. I'm really looking forward to our discussion and more about that in just a quick minute. This is going to be a 60-minute formatted program. So once again, do pay attention to the timing. If you do want to get a question or a phone call in for our guest, you want to make sure you do it while we're still broadcasting live. And, of course, email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, and the toll-free phone line is 1-866-687-7223. And a couple of other quick things to tell you about. Tomorrow, hopefully, retired General Quast will be on Hotel Mars regarding the standing up of the Space Force. That it hasn't happened for the past 2 weeks. Third time should be charmed tomorrow. And we're doing a very unusual Thursday morning space show that I want to tell you about, 9:30 a.m. California time. And our guest is Dr. Lena DeWin, and she is one of the top people at Asgardia Space. Many of you know what that is. And she is in Moscow, and we're going to be talking to her vis-a-vis a cell phone, so that should be a lot of fun. And we wanted to do an Asgardia Space program ever since we found out about it a couple of years ago, and it's finally happening. And I hope you'll be interested in listening, and you'll come armed with lots and lots of questions about Asgardia joining it. Is it really a space society and a space government? This will be your opportunity to find out about it. And then Friday at 9:30, Dr. Brandenburg returns. He has lots of new information for us, so you definitely want to tune in. Plus, he told us he is writing now I don't know how he does this, so maybe some of you will ask him, an unofficial, unauthorized autobiography. So I'm not quite sure how you do that, but that's what he's busy doing. And we'll hear more about that on Friday morning. And Open Lines is on Sunday. All of your calls and your participation, of course, are welcome, and we look forward to that. Again, toll-free number, 866-687-7223. Our newsletter is up on our homepage. Go to the upper right, and you'll see it. And make sure you scroll down. You'll see all the programs we're planning between now and the end of the year. Remember that all of our programs are archived. You can quickly download a show or also listen right off of our website. Don't forget our Space Show store. You get there by clicking on the pictures of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and she'll take you right into our Cafe Press logo-ware store. And then the Listen Live button in the upper left, this tells you how to listen to the live broadcast like we're doing now, podcasts for whatever device and platform you're interested in. And also archives, which are compressed MP3s off of our website. If you have any questions, let me know. And if you have some recommendations for other podcasting clients that you think would be good for the Space Show, let us know. We've dropped the ball on a couple of them, and we're picking those back up to see if we can get on them. But if you have a recommendation or a favorite one and we're not on it with our podcast, do let us know, and we'll do our best to rectify that as soon as possible. Our guest tonight, and I'm very happy to introduce for the very first time, Melody Yashar. She is a design architect, technologist, and researcher. Plus, she is the co-founder of Space Exploration Architecture. And this is involving the practice and developing of human-supporting concepts for space exploration. She's been a senior research associate via San Jose State Research Foundation with the Human Systems Integration Division at NASA Ames, and an associate researcher with UC Davis Center for Human Robotics Vehicle Integration and Performance. She was a team leader for the space exploration submissions to Phase 3 of NASA's 3D printed Habitat Challenge, and they won first prize in final design as well as first prize in construction levels 1 and 2. They were also awarded the top prize in design with NASA's Centennial Challenge for 3D printed HABs on Mars in Phase 1 for Mars Ice House and Phase 3 for Mars X House. You can continue to read about her and her background on her website. Her full bio is up there. I suggest you go to her website, and you can reach it by using Google, and you do search, S-E-R-C-H, and then the plus sign, and that will take you to Space Exploration Architecture. Melody, welcome to the show tonight. How are you? And we're glad to have you on board the space show.
Thanks so much, David. Thank you for that wonderful intro. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here.
How did you get your interest in space design, architecture, space development and research, and space architecture, and then founding this company or helping to found this company? Sort of give us the intro to how all of this came about for you.
Yeah. The origins of Search Plus, which is shorthand for Space Exploration Architecture, that's the startup that, and what I like to refer to as an applied research practice that I co-founded along with four other co-founders. It started when many of us met initially at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture. There was a space studio there that many of us were involved in and had participated in, and a majority of the group that ended up winning the Phase 1 NASA Centennial Challenge for a 3D printed habitat on Mars met there, and we decided to form a team. And that team ended up winning. That team was Search Plus Clouds AO, and we ended up winning first place unanimously among the judges for a proposal called Mars Ice House. And as a result of that, Search gained popularity. We started to receive phone calls. We started to receive some attention for the work that we had done in the space architecture realm, which, of course, is a very new and kind of developing field. And we began consulting, essentially, and putting together additional concepts relevant to space architecture, space design, human factors, as well as just human-centered design in general for the aerospace domain. So that's the origin of Search Plus. And I do want to say that it's a little confusing. If you Google Search Plus, you will typically were the first Google result, were the first result on Google, but our URL is actually www.spacexarch.com.
Okay. Since this has always puzzled me, but since we don't have much in space, hardware in space, although hopefully there will be some hardware flying soon, where do you get to practice space architecture? Is there any outlet where the designs are actually about to be flown, or maybe being worked into remodels of the ISS, or maybe they played a role on some of the commercial capsules, or maybe even Orion? How is space architecture getting into the field, or is it still waiting to actually get deployed?
I think it's a both and. I think that certainly internally at NASA, particularly NASA Johnson, there is a human habitability division. And there are space architects working in-house at NASA, you know, currently as we speak. And, of course, throughout the last several decades, there have been many concepts and programs for more, I guess you could say, extensive space habitats to be flown, such as Transhab, for example, or, you know, and now Gateway is being thought of in similar ways. But as far as the surface habitat work is concerned, particularly the proposals that that my group has put together relevant to occupying, or I shouldn't say occupying, to actually autonomously constructing habitats on the Moon and Mars, this is still very, very far out, still speculative work. And it's intentionally so because we try and project a vision of what could be and what a best possible outcome, aspirational vision could be should the engineering get it all right and the funding be there so that we can actually, aspire towards these really inspirational visions of what it actually means to thrive in outer space and not just survive, similar to the way that we might imagine doing so aboard the ISS. So we really do project to a preferred future, and we try and find the sweet spot between, or what I refer to as the sweet spot between, what we consider to be human-centered design approaches that really celebrate human life in outer space with innovations in systems engineering that can introduce additional value that probably has never really been seen before.
I already have a question for you from an email listener. Sherry is in Houston, Texas, and she says, good evening, Melody. David has quite a few human factors, aerospace medicine doctors on the program, and has over the many years he's been doing the space show. One of their consistent gripes is that the space designers for the human environment don't really consult or work with the aerospace medicine doctors, nor do the hard engineers. So there's always compromises being made, usually by the medicine side, that is not optimum for human life in space, be it in orbit or going someplace in space, or probably someplace else in space, although they haven't gotten that far yet. Do you coordinate with hard engineering as well as the medical side in your designs?
What a great question. Ironically, last year I had worked on a Trish grant. Trish is the Translational Research Institute for Space Health. And part of the goal, or I guess the ambition of Trish, is to look for pioneering and forward-thinking progressive research that can have a near-term application here on Earth and a long-term application in space. And one of the things that I really aspired to in the research that I was doing for that grant was to bring a human-centered perspective that typically would not be appreciated or considered when it comes to space health and space medicine. So looking at human needs, looking at human factors, looking at usability issues and habitability issues and functional issues that just, you know, are something that can be qualitatively surmised. So in the space architecture domain in particular, it is absolutely not a given by any means or standards that a traditional aerospace engineering workflow would consider or value or factor in the thoughts the value system of a space architect or a designer, because they just don't share the same value system very often. So it's a constant battle of having to advocate for the value of having a human-centered designer, human factors-based designer on board, and introducing that value and sort of arguing for it and advocating for it as we go. Very fortunately, we've been able to work with a couple of private aerospace companies. One of them was UTAS at the time, now Collins, and they were extremely appreciative of the fact that as designers we could introduce additional value that had not been there, that would not have been there using a traditional systems engineering workflow. So we looked for possibilities in design. We looked for additional ergonomic issues that might not have been brought up in their traditional workflows, and they were really, really gracious to celebrate our design development process as we were working with them. But that is not a, I don't think that's a typical example of the way that designers work within aerospace. I think that space architecture, industrial design, and human factors, and even human-computer interaction and UX and UI tend to be segregated and kind of undervalued depending on who you're speaking with. So it is a there is a bit of a struggle there.
Why do you think that is? Is it just traditional, or do they not understand, you know, the need to integrate all of this together? Why would there be the need to sort of struggle and advocate for it?
Yeah, I think that traditionally the aerospace industry is extremely risk adverse. I mean, when we're talking about human spaceflight in particular, which is typically what we are thinking about and working on, there is great risk involved. And to bring somebody such as a designer such as, you know, my group or such as myself, who is thinking out of the box and really starting at like a super, super low technology readiness level to really shake things up and reimagine the possibilities from day one, that can make people pretty anxious. Because, you know, we're purposely trying to incorporate methods and technologies and ways of approaching problems that have not been tried and tested. So that is something that is a source of tension, I think.
Are you seeing it changing, or is it about the same?
I think it depends on who you're speaking with, I think, and it also depends on the kind of technology development timeline that you're working on with. And certainly, I think private industry is really pushing for more aspirational concepts that can bring us closer to a sustainable presence on the moon and Mars. And in so doing, I think that in particular, space architecture projects are really being pushed to the forefront of people's imagination of what can be possible, should be possible. So I think that design visions, future visions of life in space are becoming more and more accepted. And I'm hoping that similar to the way that the software industry in Silicon Valley has really embraced design thinking and design workflows as being equally as important as engineering workflows, I'm hoping that the aerospace industry will sort of catch up in that regard.
Joe is in Tucson with a question for you, and he says space settlement is a big topic in the new commercial space industry, the space advocate industry. Do you do any consulting for lunar habitats or maybe even orbital space station tourist hotels with any companies that are actually viable and could do something commercially in these fields?
Well, at the moment, Search is collaborating with, is working on the IMPACT effort, which is a project that is being led by NASA Marshall, and they're collaborating with us. Let me explain what IMPACT is. IMPACT is the Moon to Mars Autonomous Planetary Construction Technology Project, and essentially the goal of that of this effort is to additively construct sustainable infrastructure on the moon and have that be a kind of foundation basically a foundation for Mars development as well. And we are collaborating and working directly with Icon 3D, which is a startup based in Austin, Texas. They are the leading concrete 3D printing company here in the States. They are the only concrete 3D printing company to have a fully permitted 3D printed house. And together we are working to actively have a demonstration on a CLIPS mission by 2028, and within the decade following, hopefully introduce sustainable infrastructure that will set us up to to create habitats on the moon?
Everything's pretty far out, right? Nothing really close near term, probably because there aren't any projects that are close near term. Is that, would you be ready? I guess what I would say is, would you be ready to do something near term if there was actually a company capable of doing something either in free space or the moon pretty near term? Are you a choke point, or would you be ready to fulfill something for design for a prototype, say, in free space or on the lunar surface?
Certainly we could produce a design, but, you know, developing prototypes that are actually functional, that can maintain a kind of pressurized interior and that are tried and tested and that have gone through, you know, the systems engineering workflows that would be expected of flight-ready hardware is just not something that we would be, that anyone, I think, is ready to do when it comes to a surface habitat in space. I think the first step would be to create mock-ups here on Earth in extreme environments, and that is something that several groups are kind of striving for. Of course, NASA has a whole legacy and history of creating human analogs for research, and I'm hoping that there will be more synergy in the space architecture domain and creating inhabitable structures that we can actually test and prototype in the short term here on Earth, and that can work in conjunction with some of the efforts of NASA and the human research program to create these analogs. Because I think that there's a lot of synergy to be found there, and it just hasn't happened yet, unfortunately.
Have you consulted or done any work with any of the commercial capsules like Dragon or what Boeing is doing, or Orion, which of course is not really commercial, but do you know if they're following sort of these design synergistic approaches, or what can you say about them?
I really can't say much about them. I know that at one point I knew of several industrial designers that were working at SpaceX, and many of them were laid off. So I think that my understanding is that it had been more of a value earlier on, and then now it's slowly waning. But I haven't worked with any of those companies myself to be able to say.
What about in other countries? Does this subject even come up? Is there an international market even for the discussion that we're having, or is this primarily in the U.S. with the commercial industry that seems to be developing in this direction?
Oh, I think absolutely that ESA, JAXA, and other space groups and agencies internationally are extremely interested in the possibility of sustainable and permanent human habitats on the moon and Mars, and many of the more inspiring proposals and interesting proposals that I've come across that have inspired the work that Search Plus has done has been from ESA and JAXA. And certainly I'm hoping in the future that we will be able to collaborate at an international scale. It just hasn't happened as of yet.
Are you ahead of your time, or is this time needed for development in R&D? I guess in terms of marketing and being a commercial operation, are you at the right time, or are you jumping in a little bit too early, or maybe even a little bit too late? How do you assess your market timing?
I don't really think that's a great question. I'm reluctant to say that there's a thriving market for space architecture, because I don't think that there is. I think that we're on the precipice of it becoming something much bigger. And I think that we're going to have to wait another 5-10 years for that to actually happen and for these ideas to really be something that multiple groups and institutions want to invest in. So we're definitely still within a kind of, we're working at a schematic level. And very consciously, you know, like it's not something that we let us that we let bring us down. Like, we really do see ourselves as part futurists, visionaries, and also kind of, you know, thinking more synergistically about how we can create short-term value here on Earth by prototyping some of the systems, whether they be 3D printed or not, here in the short term, and then in the long term introduce a vision for how we can inhabit, how we can create sustainable infrastructure on the Moon and Mars, and additively construct habitats in space. So it's a both and. I don't think that there's a thriving market by any means just yet, but we're setting ourselves up to be ready once there is.
So do you do more conventional or traditional architectural consulting and systems engineering work, or are you totally focused on the space habitats?
One of the really outstanding byproducts of the work that we've done is that we've been approached by, for example, a commercial real estate company called Lendlease, and other kind of technology development companies having to do with terrestrial construction, because they're interested in how we can learn from and benefit from research having to do with construction in space here on Earth. So we've been able to collaborate with these companies and come up with concepts that can introduce dual-use value for how, you know, we can implement a research and development program in the short term within these companies, and that can range from, like, a material system to a 3D printed system, a facade system, an environmental system, and really, you know, we've been able to think through and work collaboratively with these companies to think about the future of construction here on Earth and not just in space.
John is in Berkeley, California, and he says, I'm an architectural student at Cal, and I'm interested in space and in these fields. I don't really see any architectural coursework that leads me in that direction. What do you suggest? I'm not sure if Columbia was any different. What do you do to study, to learn about space architecture and the kind of design in initiatives that you would have to put into place? Is there a course or a terrestrial equivalent?
That's a great question. I didn't know about, well, the University of Houston has a program called CIXA, and I believe it is the only space architecture program available in the world. It's a degree program. Many of the people that I'm collaborating with right now have graduated from that program. And it's extremely, extremely impressive what they do there. But apart from that, I think largely my group, our core group of co-founders, has been largely self-educated. We try and stay as active as we can in publishing and remaining conscious of the research that's being done in this field. Certainly, there are major players across NASA and academically who have had great influence on the trajectory of space architecture from the past until now. And we've been very fortunate to remain in close contact with several of them and to have them be, you know, great influencers in the way that we approach our work and think about our work. Myself, I also try and stay involved in research and publishing more broadly. I stay involved with AIAA, and I don't know. I think that's really it.
Does AIA have a space architecture wing to it?
They do. They have a space architecture technical committee, which is headed by Olga Benovana. That's said by several people, but she is also, I believe, the director of the CIXA program at the University of Houston. It is a great subcommittee, they actively participate in several conferences, including ISIS, including the IAC, I believe AIAA, ASCEND. These are some of the conferences that they typically have sessions for?
I'm on your website, and I'm looking at really, really cool, great designs, you know, for Mars X House, for example. So would this really be like a design on Mars, or is this sort of to get people's attention? Could something really look like this and be functional, or what are we actually looking at?
Yeah, so for Mars X House versions 1 and 2, as well as Mars Ice House, basically all of the Mars proposals that you'll see on the Search Plus website, these were specific design solutions that were introduced in response to NASA's Centennial Challenge for 3D printed habitat. And what they did in each of those challenges is they introduced a design brief with specific requirements. So we were designing a habitat with a certain minimum amount of square footage for a crew of four to inhabit a structure for one Earth year on the surface of Mars. And they gave us the minimum program requirements for what we needed to include within the habitat. This included some minimum mechanical, electrical, and plumbing equipment, as well as ECLIS environmental control and life support equipment. And then they also asked us to develop the structural system for the habitat, as well as its deployment to a certain level of detail. So all of these criteria were factored into the design of each of these proposals, and they were given, you know, a score as put forward within NASA's guidelines and rules requirements. And there was also a big emphasis on autonomous construction. And so each of these proposals, Mars Ice House, Mars X House version 1 and 2, introduce a system whereby we can autonomously gather local and indigenous materials on the Martian surface and using in situ resource utilization, autonomously construct these habitats using a number of robotic means and mechanisms. And all of those means and mechanisms were sort of put forward at a schematic level, as given, you know, the name of the competition, the 3D printed habitat competition. They all include some element of 3D printing or additive construction. And, those are basically the parameters whereby the proposals all came together.
Could something like this be built as terrestrial housing here on Earth, as maybe, you know, a sort of a project demo or something, and could it be built autonomously here on Earth?
That's a great question. I think that striving for autonomy when it comes to building construction is definitely a challenge. Not only, you know, in space, but here on Earth as well. I mean, you can just look at the current state of the building construction industry as it is right now, and imagine how difficult it would be to build at scale and create, you know, rated buildings for human occupancy and have it all be autonomously constructed by robots. We are far, far way away from that. On the other hand, the real benefit of 3D printing and additive construction in space is that it introduces great versatility. So you can 3D print a road, any kind of horizontal structure, a landing pad, berms, trenches, blast walls, and then hopefully in the future we can project to where we're actually creating pressurized seals and pressurized hermetic barriers that can contain pressure on the inside so that people can live, you know, within habitats. But it's that versatility which I think is one of the reasons why 3D printing and additive construction has been so celebrated until now as a building construction technology that should be and is heavily invested in for planetary construction, off-world planetary construction. But in the short term, we really try and break up our proposals and what could feasibly be constructed as a prototype into material systems, wall systems, and habitability, I guess, concept. So there are many, many elements and that get put together in our thinking of the way that we approach these habitat proposals. And I think it's misleading to think that, you know, that X house needs to be constructed in a particular way terrestrially to represent what we've actually designed to be the best possible configuration on Mars. There are a couple of interesting elements relevant to X house version 2, for example, such as a 3D printed inner high density polyethylene layer, and then a sulfur concrete, which would be part of the regolith shell on the outside, the salt fibrous reinforcement, which would be embedded within the the sulfur-based concrete. These are all individual elements that have been of the material system that have gained attention and that people have been super interested in to scale to the point where we can actually think of them as building construction materials and hopefully as something that we can implement within a prototype here on Earth in the short term today. But by no means do we think or do we aspire to replicate the proposals that we have introduced for NASA Centennial Challenges here on Earth, because they're extremely complex. And we look forward to a future where we can actually do all of this work autonomously. But until then, we've got to do it telerobotically first, and we've got to really improve the way that autonomous construction robotics actually integrate with to function safely with people. And yeah, there's so much to do, and there's so much there that we can sort of unpack.
So I'm looking at version 2, which is mm-hmm. is totally cool. So when you did this, do you make like working drawings for how this would be put together and what the inside is like, or is it basically rendering type of photos or models?
Yeah, we essentially start by drawing pen to paper. We work out the programming of the habitat, meaning how the functions are separated, what sorts of spaces we're providing for the entire crew, which would be public and communal, versus what sorts of spaces we're providing within an individual crew cabin. We take a look at where, you know, things like comms and where mission control storage and other sort of like resources could be located within the habitat. And at that point, we construct a 3D model, which would factor in not only all of the individual kind of like outfitting, furnishing, the ECLIS equipment, the mechanical equipment, but also the material system for the structural shells. All of that gets put together in a 3D model. And depending on which project we're talking about, it would happen within a particular workflow, which is becoming more traditionally accepted within the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, which is known as BIM, Building Information Modeling. The hope being that BIM workflows can better integrate or synthesize with with the added benefit that we will gain using 3D printing technologies. So BIM is traditionally, you know, terrestrially used as a way of sort of monitoring construction progress as well as the data that we get from a building, not only before it's built, but also after it's built, once it's occupied, and once the actual, like, building life cycle is sort of, you know, brought to life. BIM for future space habitats is one way of tracking how your material system could be employed if we're going to use ISRU construction. And it's definitely an area of developing research that that still has a ways to go, but it's extremely interesting because it's bridging software tools that we use terrestrially with future tools that we can only hope will be, that we can only imagine will be created for autonomous robotics.
You have a patient phone caller waiting. Hopefully they're still waiting. Hi, caller.
Okay.
Welcome to our program tonight. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall in little old Renfro, Oklahoma.
Marshall, and we all know you're from Oklahoma, you know, and I, since I'm from Oklahoma, I love it that you announce that all the time, but you really don't have to keep doing that hillbilly introduction.
Well, I got it. It's my warm-up line. Anyway, one of the biggest problems on the International Space Station is the fact that the astronauts need to exercise, and I do mean a whole bunch. And when you go to the moon or Mars, there's going to be a need to do something besides video games. So it's kind of like, what requirements have there been in the architectures proposals for, you know, physical exercise game rooms?
That's a great question. It's definitely something that we have loosely thought about, but not in any great detail. So we always try and put some sort of exercise equipment or some sort of exercise zone. The way that architects typically work is by zoning particular areas of a habitat according to a function. We typically create an exercise zone that is in close proximity to a medical zone or a medical module. But that's about it. I think that we don't really get into too much detail apart from being able to say and stress and represent the fact that it's a critical need.
Mm-hmm. Well, my favorite concept has always been 0G to 1G racquetball. But but one of the fun parts about that is, how do you ventilate it? And how much ventilation do you have going through? And, you know, obviously if you're at one-third G, it's a different animal than it is at one-sixth G. And obviously, well, I don't think you'll ever get on the International Space Station, but a zero-G module would be interesting also.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds fun.
Melody, do you, along the lines of what Marshall is indicating, do you plan for, design, even contemplate artificial gravity somehow spinning, doing something along the lines of exercises, as Marshall is suggesting? Are you coping with artificial gravity, for example?
I myself have not really worked on it specifically, but I'm actually, this is the first semester that I'm kicking off a course at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena called Life on the Moon. And it's essentially looking at the future of space tourism. And we're looking not only at the surface of the moon and structures that can be created for the purposes of tourism and sort of entertainment on the lunar surface, but also in orbital space. So I'm imagining that that's something that is going to be expanded on in this class in particular and students' work.
Did you say that this was at Pasadena City College?
This is at Art Center College of Design.
Okay.
And this is in Pasadena. It's in the city of Pasadena.
Okay. It's not online where people not at the Art Center can take an audit or if they're interested, like Marshall, for example.
Unfortunately not, but I'm hoping that in the future that might be something that we would be able to do, or that we would be able to present some of the outcomes of the course, because it is going to continue, I believe, in future semesters, and hopefully gain some insight from people who are interested in similar concepts. And, possibly collaborate in the future as well.
Are you the teacher of the course?
I am the teacher of the course, yes.
Do you have people coming over from JPL? Do they have any interest in this area?
Not yet. So far, it is the first time that it's being offered. so it hasn't really, I don't think anybody at JPL knows about it yet. It's really internal to Art Center. But the really unique thing about Art Center so far, well, first of all, Art Center has collaborated with JPL, so it's unironic that you say that. But one of the unique things that I really appreciate about the school is that it combines a mix of transportation design, so aircraft and vehicles, particularly cars. They're very well known for cars. Transportation design with traditional industrial design, environmental design, with product design, and then, of course, a whole range of traditional arts and making disciplines. So it's really an interesting place to gain a new perspective on design and what the future of design will be. So I'm hoping we're going to have some really interesting outcomes from this work.
Okay. Marshall, anything more from you? Do you have a...
Well, I was wondering, what's the possibility of space-based football? In other words, can you build a Dallas Cowboys-size arena to play football in space? And I'm kind of going, wow, what a concept.
Why would you even think about football in space? Anyway, let's see what Melody has to say.
Yeah.
Marshall, I'm not sure I can comment on that, but it is a fun idea.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, the concept of a 50-yard punt all of a sudden becomes, what's the problem? You don't really need much of a quarterback to throw a 200-yard pass.
Well,
oh, well,
there have been space advocate sort of oriented companies and entrepreneurial ideas for games, Olympic games, even even swimming, flying on the moon, you know, without an aircraft, just, you know, like they tried to do with Da Vinci flying and things like that. So, why not add in basketball, too, you know, Marshall?
Yeah.
Might as well just throw the whole thing in there.
Yeah, it sounds like one day of one day lecture in the concept of design, where everybody just gets goofy.
Boxing might be fun in that environment.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah, how far can you toss your opponent?
Melody, are you familiar with the USC space architecture professor Madhu Thangavelu?
Yes, I am. He's wonderful.
So have you ever participated in his design class where he lets his students do design projects and they just run totally wild with imagination? Nothing plausible at all, but some of it's fun.
I've been on a few of his reviews, and those projects are extremely fun, yes.
I just wonder, someone there might, Marshall, build you a football stadium on the moon.
Well, until next time, guys.
Thank you very much, Marshall. Listeners, the phone line is available, and there is still time if you would like to give us a call tonight, 866-687-7223. Overall, Melody, is not just your company, but in general, are we moving at a fast pace toward this kind of future, or are we stagnating or just making little tiny baby steps?
I think we're active. I think we're working. I think we're working as hard as we can. Certainly, private industry is leading the way when it comes to the technology development goals that we want to meet, to additively construct on the moon and eventually Mars. And, it'll take as long as it needs to, but I do think that there are key players on the stage that are not going to compromise getting us there. So it's very promising.
You have another caller waiting for you. Hang on, callers. Hello, caller. Welcome to the program tonight. Who are you? Where are you? And we appreciate your call.
This is Doug from Redlands, California.
Hi, Doug. Go for it.
Hi. Hey, just in reply to Marshall's question about Habitat for Football, I have emailed the leading researcher at NASA for inflatable habitats, and she gave me the how much mass per square meter the different layers of the habitat would be. And as I do the calculations, a starship delivering 100 tons of the outermost layer, which comes at about 1 kilogram per meter squared, would be able to establish a footprint of between 8 and 9 acres. So actually, you could, you know, that's obviously bigger than a regular football field. So it's actually theoretically possible.
So Marshall can see Oklahoma State football games there. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you have to ship the players, but yeah. you'd have to change things because you could throw ridiculously long distance, you know. So I'm not sure how. You'd have to change the rules, I think.
Do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I do. I have developed a concept for an initial habitat, which I call the Unihab, that has unified within a single habitat all of the zones needed to support an initial crew of 8, including 35% of the volume for hydroponic greenhouse. That would be able to supply all the calories and then also process air and water for the crew of 8. And then there's also living areas and work areas and an area for an indoor centrifuge. I'm working in the Space Development Network. This is a organization, sort of volunteer organization for space advocates, so we just work voluntarily. And I know that space architects, like spacearchitects.org, I think it is, are
right.
Professionals. But is there a way that I could collaborate with somebody, maybe there at the art design, Art College of Design?
I think spacearchitect.org, well, many members of the AIAA Space Architecture Technical Committee are also members of spacearchitect.org. So there's a lot of crossover there, and I think it's a tremendous resource. But I'm on spacearchitect.org. As well as many of my colleagues and collaborators, and it is a great, great resource for reaching out to a network of people that are working and practicing in space architecture, definitely.
Okay. As I've been on the website, the architects that are, I guess, members of this organization have really standardized email addresses like firstname.lastname@spacearchitect.org, something like that. Does that actually forward email to these individuals?
That's a great question. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes I get emails from them, and sometimes I miss them entirely. So it might be worth reaching out to those people through other means, but it's worth a try. Typically, it should work. Yes.
Okay. And I'm sorry, AIAA, did you say Space Architecture Technical Committee?
That's correct. Yes.
SATC?
Yes, SATC.
Okay, very well. Also, as I looked at your website, I counted there's 18 habitats on Mars and arguably one habitat shown depicted on the moon. Why is there, it seems to me as though when space architects want to design habitats, but they always seem to be focused on Mars, including 3D printed. I'm not sure I've really seen very many images of habitats on the moon. Is this your perception as well?
Well, I can only speak for the work that we've been involved in. And the lion's share of that work has been a response to the NASA Centennial Challenge Program. And since 2015... That program, from 2015 until 2019, that program was entirely and exclusively focused on Mars. So the program was to design for Mars, and that's why all of the representation is for Mars. And then moving forward, you know, the program has shifted. The emphasis of the program has shifted. And as I mentioned earlier, we're currently working on a lunar project. So some of that might just be a result of the number of projects that you might find online and, frankly, the amount of press that has been generated as a result of the NASA Centennial Challenge for a 3D printed habitat. But certainly, certainly, if you look back throughout the decades, there are a ton of lunar habitat proposals that have been introduced from NASA and from other agencies, private and public, and those should not be underestimated. It's really interesting to me when you go back and look at some of these more historical projects from the 50s and 60s, and they're all just as viable as they were when they were imagined as many of the proposals that, you know, I see coming out today are, because not much has changed in terms of technology when it comes to getting ourselves to the moon. So, I would not factor out some of the more historical concepts that that might not be as readily available on Google image search.
So I approach my space advocacy work primarily from a technical standpoint, and it strikes me that I can think of at least three major problems with 3D printed habitat, especially as compared with inflatable habitat.
There's no shortage of problems. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, well, from a technical standpoint, have you compared 3D printed versus inflatables in terms of like?
We have. As far as the 3D printed habitat competition went, one of the earlier proposals that we introduced featured a precision manufactured inflatable membrane that would be pressurized. We received direct feedback, you know, and it's interesting too because the competition has its own sort of goals and ambitions in crowdsourcing solutions to a problem brief that they put together. So we received direct feedback from the competition organizers when we had submitted this concept for an inflatable membrane that they did not want the primary pressure steel of the habitat to be an inflatable. They wanted it to be the 3D printed shell. And at the time, my understanding and my interpretation of this was that they really wanted some of the construction prototyping submissions of the competition to focus on that aspect of things and determine whether you can actually create a watertight and then eventually an airtight pressure steel using terrestrial 3D printing means, using, you know, 3D printed concrete or polymer-based extrusion, because that research just has not been developed yet. Nobody's really looking at that at scale. So they had their own motivations in mind, certainly, in giving us that feedback, and it impacted and influenced the way that we approached the design solution from there.
I think that's unfortunate because I think an inflatable airproof layer on the inside is just a very easy way of dealing with the safety issues, because that's one of the big issues that I have with 3D printed habitats, and that is if you were to construct an inflatable on Earth out of Kevlar, you can use the strongest materials, you can test it in laboratory environments, you can really prove it's safe before launching it. With 3D habitat, you know, how do you test that? Do you construct it on the moon or Mars, and then do you overpressure it beyond a certain point? It seems, you know, and you got to make it really thick to be able to have the same strength as like Kevlar. So,
yeah.
And it takes a long time if you're not shipping binder or producing binder. Then what are you centering and how much energy? What's the energy budget for that? It strikes me that there's just so many fundamental issues. I fear that when it comes to form and function, that form is going overboard to the hazard of function when there could be perhaps some alternate, simpler, more straightforward solutions. But because 3D printed habitats look so cool and get a lot of good press for NASA and people participating, that there's been this sort of bias towards Mars and towards 3D printed habitats. I think at the loss of alternate approaches, which I think would be faster, more cost effective, be produced in a shorter time, et cetera.
I don't disagree with you that these alternate means and methods would be more time and cost efficient. Absolutely. I'm so totally on board with you. The real idea, though, for these proposals, and I say this not, you know, I say this very consciously, is that it is intended to project a future vision that is aspirational and get the public excited about a future where we can actually live in space. And not only that, but it is really pushing a narrative where we want to strive for 100% ISRU. Is that easy? Is that reasonable within the current kind of technology development roadmaps that we're working with? Probably not. And is it safe? Absolutely not. But from a kind of graphic standpoint and imagistic standpoint, it is something that I've learned is a narrative that the competition in particular would had liked to push. So I say that very consciously. You know, I think that particularly for a lunar habitat, a super easy way to create an occupiable structure in the, you know, within a reasonable timeline and with a reasonable budget on the moon would be to inflate, would be to use an inflatable, or even better, to take a hard shell, launch a hard shell module, place it on the surface of the moon, and cover it with regolith. It doesn't need to be
centered
at all, you know? But, you know, I think that the real benefit that that architects and designers bring to the table is that it is extremely easy to come up with these graphic images of what could be without investing in an actual scientific and technical program to manifest it and have it become real. So it's easy to iterate, it's cheap to iterate, and it's a vision of the future that the public can actually get excited about and be enthusiastic about so that, you know, additional technology development work can happen. So are these solutions necessarily, like, the best or most efficient ones? Absolutely not. But they do serve other means. They do serve other purposes. And, yeah, I'm very aware of that.
Okay, yeah, I think we see things a lot alike. What I wish is that more creativity would go into inflatable habitat design, because I think there's a lot of creative space there that very few people are exploring, while 3D printing is getting all of the attention. You know, inflatables don't, we see them, you know, as we drive by on the road and we have, you know, some company has the inflatable gorilla, you know, outside of their business. It just sort of illustrates that you can do all sorts of, you know, beautiful designs with curved walls and roofs and, you know, all these sorts of things.
Doug, didn't they have inflatable field hospitals in different places for COVID when they thought it was going to be a lot worse? Plus, the military uses inflatable field hospitals that work pretty well.
Yeah, I actually, when I was in Haiti after the earthquake, you know, serving at a mission hospital there, the international organization actually just donated an inflatable hospital, which is great because we were a bit nervous about working inside the hospital when there's all these aftershocks, and so we were glad. You could even do surgeries in these things.
Yeah, they set them up on the campus of San Quentin Prison after they sent a bunch of COVID prisoners to San Quentin, and then the whole prison got infected, and then it spread into Marin County. So this is another brilliant part of public policy. But they put inflatables on the campus of, I guess you could call it a campus for a prison, I'm not sure, maybe just the grounds of San Quentin, so that they kept the sick patients there rather than bringing them into hospitals around the Bay Area, which was spreading COVID all over the place. So, and we could drive by and we could see inflatables, you know, there. So you know, they must work okay. And I guess you can seal them off so they can be compact and tight.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about inflatables is you just open a valve of a container of condensed air, and against the vacuum, the thing will unfold and construct itself in an afternoon, you know.
Uh-huh.
You don't have to wait months and use a lot of power producing a habitat. You can just inflate it, and it's done.
And so, it's durable. Anyway, go ahead and finish up.
Well, yeah, that's all I had to say. I look forward to reaching out to you guys and seeing if we can work together.
You're not far from Pasadena. Maybe you want to look into her course.
Oh, yeah, this goes to everybody. Feel free to reach out. Feel free to reach out via our website, spacexarc.com, or shoot an email, and I would absolutely be happy to follow up with anybody who might be interested in speaking further.
I actually have a memory when I was in high school. I was taking an art class, and the art teacher took us to the, and they helped me with the term, California Center for Art and Design.
Yeah, it's the big museum science center in Los Angeles.
Right.
Right?
California Science Center, yeah.
And it has the
No.
Not that
the
one?
Science Center there in Pasadena.
Oh, okay. California, what's the name of where you're teaching your class again, Melody?
Oh, I'm at Art Center College of Design.
Art Center College of Design. So she took us there, and it was incredibly memorable. I saw they were carving out of clay designs for cars, which were really cool. There was I never thought about it, but they had a whole package, you know, packaging for products design, which is also very cool. It was sort of funny, you know, I was coming from a Christian high school, and apparently some of the students looked in through one door, and I guess students were painting a nude model. And for, you know, 17-year-old boys were like, oh, my, you know. So it was quite a memorable field trip. And I think what you guys do there is incredibly cool, unbelievably cool.
Okay.
Thanks.
Doug, thanks a lot.
Sure thing.
Okay. Listeners, you need to hurry up if you want to get a call in or an email in to our guest tonight, because we're actually over the hour limit that we talked about. Have we left anything out, Melody? Is there something that you wanted to be sure to include that we haven't included, for example?
Not that I can think of. I'm happy to follow up with anybody if they want to send over an email via our website. There's lots more information there. We have a number of project videos on Mars Ice House and Mars X House. They're only a few minutes each, and they will give a quick introduction to the concept for the habitat, the deployment, the construction sequence, and some of the thinking that we put into these proposals that were awarded by NASA.
Okay. Your company do? What are you doing now? What are you involved in another design contest, or what? Where is your energy focused right now?
Right now, we are working on the IMPACT project with NASA Marshall. That is the Moon to Mars Autonomous Construction, Planetary Autonomous Construction Technology project in collaboration with ICON 3D. And that is all about, we're creating a system for sustainable lunar infrastructure.
Okay. Is there an end point to that project? I'm thinking of a future space show, if this project has an end point with a conclusion.
Possibly. We have a month and some time before we release the outcomes of that project. And I actually think that ICON 3D will be making, and NASA will be making, an announcement on this project in the coming week. So that's basically as much as I can share at the moment, but yes, the outcomes of that project and our design product and some of the planning involved that will be, the planning that we're that we're developing moving forward is going to be shared with that announcement.
And it's Icon D, as in David 3?
Icon 3D.
Icon 3D, okay.
And I believe their URL is Icon Build.
Icon Build? Is that what
you said? Yeah, if you Google Icon 3D, you will likely come up, you will likely find them on Google.
Okay. Terrific. Well, I hope we can follow up with you and continue to talk to you about some of this great work that still needs to be done, but it appears that it is being done. So that's a great start over when I started the space show 20 years ago, when it was just dreamed about by very few people, but it wasn't even actually being worked on. There weren't even design concepts. So progress is progress. You take it where you can find it, I guess. I hope we do get to talk again, and I definitely want to say thank you for coming on the space show tonight. And listeners, those of you who sent in emails and those of you who called, also thank you. I forgot to thank our sponsors, everybody, so let me throw that in as we did the shorter segment tonight. So I just want to give a shout-out to our sponsors, Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Integrated Space Plan. We would not be doing this program without our great sponsors. Make sure you click from time to time on their banner ads, see what they have underneath the curtain, so to speak. And if you're interested in being a sponsor, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Melody, it's great to get to meet you on the program, and I am hopeful that we can talk again down the road, and I look forward to some more fun designs and to you're actually doing something that that works in space, even if it's not 3D printing. But I hope I'm still around when that happens, and I look forward to it. Thank you again, and we appreciate it. Listeners,
thanks so much, David. This was really fun.
Okay, well, it's always fun for me. I get to do this 4 or 5 times a week, so great fun. And my dog even came up to share with us a little bit. By the way, I always ask the space architects this, so I might as well ask you this too. For settlement and talking about families and other things, do you get involved or do you know people that actually do some kind of planning for family living on a space settlement, which I guess would include kids, maybe even pets like dogs? Or I don't know about cats, but does anyone do family architecture, space architectural type of planning for space settlements?
Not that I'm not familiar with anyone, but that doesn't mean that someone's not thinking about it.
Because I guess that's going to be needed if space settlements really get established and they really include families and some of the things I've heard people talk about. I guess they'd have to plan for that kind of thing. So, something else to think about. Listeners, that's it for tonight. And remember, Hotel Mars is tomorrow. Remember the special show, 9:30 Thursday morning on Asgardia. And if you're not quite sure what this space society is, Google Asgardia Space and then listen to the program and ask away, and hopefully everything works as we connect by cell phone to Moscow. And then Brandenburg is back on Friday and open lines on Sunday, a full week on the space show. Special thanks to Melody and to, again, all of you who called in and emailed and participated in tonight's show. It's a young week, so everybody have a great week, and do stay safe. And as we like to say, keep looking up. Good night from Melody, David, and the space show.